yesterday made its case for the worst weather day of the month, with downpours causing flash flooding in southern and eastern Iowa. How great is the flood threat? This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In the second half hour, we'll talk with two hydrologists about the flood picture and hopefully hear from you if you've been significantly impacted by the downpours. Before that, a trio of interesting stories from around the state this week. Some controversial anti-gay remarks made at the State House, a mysterious pipe bomb that was found and detonated in Cedar Falls, and a recent Des Moines Register investigation into Iowa's emergency medical services. It's all coming up, but first this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and we want to address the weather situation in our second half hour. Over 8 inches of rain in the town of North Liberty in the last 24 hours. We'll talk with someone there in our second half hour. Perhaps you were also one of those inundated with these downpours in southern and eastern Iowa. How have the rains complicated your life? We want to hear about it. For now, if you could check in with a post on our Facebook page or email us at rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org or tweet us. We'll get to phone calls also in the second half hour. But tell us how it's impacted you, if it's made your life quite complicated this week. In the first half hour, we want to talk about a trio of interesting stories around the state this week. A mysterious pipe bomb that was found and detonated in Cedar Falls, and a recent Des Moines Register investigation into Iowa's emergency medical services. That coming up all in the next half hour. But first, we want to talk with our State House reporter, Clay Masters, about some controversial anti-gay remarks by a lawmaker this week at the State House. You've heard the reports about them in our news. We wanted to provide a little more context to those remarks now. Clay Masters in our Des Moines studio. Hi, Clay.
Hey, Ben.
Tell us who said what and to raise this controversy.
Well, it started with Republican Senator Dennis Guth of Clemmy. He voiced concern on the Senate floor about homosexuality. He said it hurts him and his family in multiple ways. He spoke for about 10 minutes, and here's a little bit of what he had to say.
The media, for the most part, has bamboozled us into thinking that having a relationship outside of the boundaries of monogamous heterosexual marriage is positive, happy, and fulfilling. Movies, television shows, articles, and magazines abound with this theme, giving partial information to a vulnerable and impressionable audience, our children. There are health risks that my family incurs because of the increase of sexually transmitted infections that this lifestyle invites. For example, there are more and more medical tests required before giving blood or giving birth.
Again, that's Republican Senator Dennis Guth yesterday on the floor of the Senate. He was speaking out against what he called the homosexual lifestyle. He supports a statewide referendum on a constitutional amendment to ban same-sex marriage. He says the best environment for children is a family with one man and one woman committed in a long-term relationship. Now, Guth is a freshman senator, and isn't that outspoken during many of the debates taking place in the Senate?
But there was some outspoken feedback that he got in return. What was that?
Yeah, Democratic Senator Matt McCoy, who is openly gay, got up and responded to Guth's remarks. Here's a bit of what Senator McCoy, who's from Des Moines, had to say in response.
Much of what you heard today on the floor of the Senate is warmed over rhetoric that has been invented by the Christian right extreme groups. And what I heard today was ignorant, and I know where it came from. And I think that I am not gay by choice. I am not gay by choice. But I choose not to be ignorant.
And again, that's Des Moines Democratic State Senator Matt McCoy responding to Republican Senator Dennis Guth. McCoy later in the day sent out a press release saying Senator Guth should apologize to all Iowans for making the comments, McCoy said they were offensive and he was disgusted. One Iowa, the gay rights advocacy group, also issued a statement that included a quote from a married lesbian couple in Lake Mills, Iowa, which is in Senator Guth's district. The couple say their marriage and love is not a lie.
Mm-hmm. I understand this came up as a part of something called points of personal privilege. What is that? Explain it.
Well, this is basically when senators can get up at the start of the day to talk about really whatever they want to. This session, during the point of privilege time, senators have risen to talk about Medicaid expansion in that debate. There's been talk about the state's deal with Egyptian fertilizer, Orascom. But it's also a time for senators to announce it's somebody's birthday in the chamber and there's cupcakes and vegetables in the chamber to celebrate.
Right.
But it's important to clarify that this was not during debate over a bill.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if there was any further reaction. You had the reaction from McCoy, Senator McCoy, but what about the party leadership in either party, the GOP specifically? Anything there?
Well, about an hour ago, I talked with my colleague Joyce Russell, who is in the weekly State House Republican Leadership Press Conference, and Senate Minority Leader Bill Dix of Shell Rock said there was no discussion about Guth's comments in their caucus before he made them, and Senator Dix had no other comments.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. Iowa, one of the few states, one of the first states to legalize same-sex marriage. Interesting that these comments come in a legislature with this type of state. What does that have to say about what our state is going through in the context here?
Well, ever since the state Supreme Court's decision back in 2009 that paved the way for same-sex marriage in Iowa, acceptance of gays and lesbians and their marriage has remained in the political eye. That's why the vote to retain Justice Wiggins was such a big deal in the 2012 election. Of course, he was ultimately retained. And just after the election, you even had Republican Congressman and chair of the Tea Party Caucus, Steve King, saying that we just have to accept that same-sex marriage is the law of the land. But it's still an issue for some, clearly. Earlier this month, the state held the Iowa Governor's Conference on LGBTQ Youth, which stands for Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, Transgender, and Questioning Youth. And some conservative Christian activists have criticized the use of governor, or did criticize the use of governor in the title of that conference. So if public opinion is changing from 2009 in that Varnum decision, it seems the conversation will still persist.
Mm-hmm. Public opinion has changed dramatically across the country, not just in Iowa. It's we can imagine what something like this being said a generation or two ago, what that would have probably not too much controversy a generation or two ago. But also interesting, Clay, is that lawmakers, citizens express opinions all the time at our state house. This is the way a thriving democracy works. We want that. But what can you say about the boundaries about what can be said? Senator McCoy obviously feeling offended there.
Yeah, Rule 9 gets invoked now and again. That's a rule that bans senators from implying improper motives. I mean, just last month, Rule 9 was invoked on Cedar Rapids Democratic Senator Rob Hoag. He was criticizing Governor Branstad for his handling of flooding on the Missouri River. But nobody, to my understanding, called Rule 9 on Guth's comments, at least not while he was saying them on the floor.
Mm-hmm. Is this a story passed this week? Any repercussions to this little controversy at the State House?
Well, it's not quite clear yet. I mean, later in the day yesterday, Senator Guth was asked if he intended to retract his statements. He said he had no intention to do so. He said his remarks were inspired by a national event put on by conservative Christian group Focus on the Family that was held yesterday. So not anything that really signals that this will come up again or won't be. So we'll just have to keep an eye on it.
Iowa Public Radio's Clay Masters, thanks for stepping into the studio to update us on that, Clay.
Thanks, Ben.
And as always, you can leave your view on this or any other stories you hear on Iowa Public Radio at Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page. We do enjoy hearing that feedback there. Our second in our trio of stories that we wanted to delve into from this week, we all know that since Monday's Boston bombing, our nerves have good reason to be more on edge than usual, and that's why the discovery of an unexploded pipe bomb this Tuesday in Cedar Falls was especially unnerving. And joining me to tell us more about that, Iowa Public Radio's Pat Blank, joining us by phone in this case. Pat Blank in Cedar Falls. Hi, Pat.
Good morning.
Tell us, what was discovered? When was it discovered?
Well, it appears a city employee was driving a machine that sucks up debris from the storm sewer. So it looks sort of like a street sweeper, only it's more like a vacuum cleaner instead of a sweeper. And along with picking up the debris, it picked up PVC pipe capped at both ends, and it was just inadvertently then tossed up into a lawn. The worker found it and said, oh, gosh, put it up on the lawn. I mean, it didn't toss it necessarily, but gently put it up on the lawn and took a second look and thought, oh, this isn't right. And so notified police at that point. And mm-hmm. that was between 8 and 9 o'clock in the morning.
Okay, on Tuesday. And take the story from there. Police were notified. What happened?
Police were notified. Some residents in the immediate area were evacuated. A daycare was put on alert that there was something suspicious in the area. Didn't evacuate the daycare. Some parents did choose to come and pick up their children from there. And Waterloo has a bomb squad. So the nearby town of Waterloo, right next door, brought in the bomb squad. And they have a little robot. Prior to that, though, they did bring in public works folks, came in with sandbags and built a bunker around the area in which the pipe bomb was placed or the device, and then brought in a robot and rolled the robot over to the area where the pipe bomb was. It picked it up and turned it over a few times, and I understand it had an X-ray, so they were able to X-ray what was inside, and then at that point had determined that it was a real pipe bomb. It wasn't, you know, it was something that would potentially explode.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Pat. I just wanted to mention that there's some impressive pictures of this in the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier. Pictures of the bomb squad, one individual in one of these huge suits, I believe mm-hmm. one of the robots, too. Pictures that seem like they're straight out of the Hurt Locker.
Exactly. It was, you know, very frightening for everyone who lived there because, you know, was this part of an extension of what happened in Boston just the day before? And there's been no connection to that whatsoever. People, authorities especially, don't want to say, well, yes, it's something that was planted, you know, as a copycat. No one is saying that, and no one is confirming that it isn't. So right now, mm-hmm. the discussion and the investigation continues. But to get back to what happened with the pipe bomb, it took an inordinate amount of time, long period of time. The sandbags were in place by about 11, and much discussion and much, you know, the person in the suit went over and looked, and the robot, you know, picked it up and turned it over. And it wasn't until 1 o'clock, about 1:10, 1:15 in the afternoon, that it was actually detonated, and it was just really a muffled sound and a little puff of smoke, and everybody went, oh, okay.
I believe we have a little extremely short audio clip of that detonation, that planned detonation of this pipe bomb found in Cedar Falls. Let's have a listen, Pat. So that's all it was. It could have been a large firecracker that we were doing too, but a worrying thing. So a lot of questions here, and it unnerves the community, I bet, there in Cedar Falls.
Very much so, and I did talk to the police department just this morning to see if there was any further information to be dispelled this morning, and really none. Some behind-the-scenes investigation going on, but nothing to connect anybody to it at this point, and absolutely so far no connection to knowing as to exactly when it was placed there. Mm-hmm. Had it been there and it was just, you know, a circumstantial, you know, find? Did it just happen to be there, or did somebody actually put it there because they were trying to copy what happened in Boston?
You talked about the connections. I looked at this. I had to, as a personal connection to me, Pat, I didn't mention to this before this interview, but that's actually the very block that I grew up on in Cedar Falls. So I know exactly where this is, and yeah, I can imagine it. It creates a stir, especially by a child care center.
Exactly.
Okay,
yep.
Pat Blank, thanks for giving us a little context to that mysterious happening, the detonation, planned detonation of a found pipe bomb in Cedar Falls. Pat, thanks so much. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. We're scanning a few of some interesting stories from around the state this week before we get into a discussion about the flood threat caused by all that rain in parts of eastern and southern Iowa. Most of the state was hit by the rain, but primarily those heavy, heavy amounts. North Liberty, over 8 inches of rain in the last 24 hours. We'll be talking about that in our second half hour. We're asking for you to put a post on our Facebook page or email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org, or tweet us if you can tell us how you were, the downpours impacted you, your property. Perhaps it was a major headache for you this week. We'll get to that in our second half hour. Winding up this half hour, the Des Moines Register has been publishing the findings of the paper's investigation into Iowa's emergency medical services. And joining me to talk about that is the Des Moines Register reporter behind this series, behind this investigation, Clark Kaufman. Welcome to our program.
Thanks for having me.
Why did the Des Moines Register launch this series about Iowa's emergency medical services?
Well, a few years ago, I realized that while we had been sort of routinely reporting on issues facing individual physicians and nurses and other people who face sanctions from the state licensing boards, we had never looked at the Bureau of EMS, which is an entirely separate entity. Or for that matter, we'd never looked at any of the broader system issues facing the EMS system in Iowa. So a few years ago, I started the process of just looking at some of the disciplinary cases so I could get a feel for what some of the individual issues were with EMTs, but then also looking at the system-wide problems, some of which the Bureau had been trying to tackle for 5 or 6 years at that point.
Mm-hmm. So what were some of the findings that really stick out for you that you think need highlighting?
Well, there were individual problems, of course, that we found with specific EMTs, whether it was histories of theft or violent crimes or being drunk on the job, falsifying their credentials, that kind of thing. But I think the more interesting thing for me were the system problems. Iowa's one of 22 states that doesn't require background checks of EMTs at the point of licensure or renewal of their license. State inspectors have never imposed a fine against any ambulance service for failing to correct deficiencies that the inspectors find. Bureau of EMS itself, which oversees the profession, has gone through some serious budget reductions. So they're, at one point, their staff was about 17 in number. They're down to 10. And the state hasn't had an EMS medical director for 10 years, which is significant. The one thing that surprised me probably most of all was that the response times of individual agencies, individual EMS providers around the state, their average response times are collected by the state, but by law, the Bureau can't share that information publicly. And obviously, response times don't tell everything about a EMS provider, but they are one critical measure of how well the service is doing its job, but that information simply isn't accessible.
What has been the reaction, Clark, to this series? Because I imagine we've got a great number of very, very talented, skilled EMS people in the state who do a fantastic job. You've heard a lot of reaction, I assume.
Oh, yeah, we have. And, you know, that's the one thing about EMTs, not only in Iowa, but in other states. A lot of them are volunteers, and so they're very passionate about the work that they do. And the response actually was pretty close to what I expected it would be. It wasn't unlike the reaction of many EMTs when the state first proposed some new standards of care that were intended to improve accountability and enhance patient care. A lot of the EMTs wrote to the state and said, yeah, these new standards that you're proposing will improve patient outcomes, but they'll also expose us to some embarrassment and to some potential litigation if we fail to meet those standards. So there is, and this is true of all professions, my own included, I think there's a real resistance to even acknowledging some of these broader systemic problems that exist, which, of course, is always the first painful step of trying to improve things. And so we heard from a lot of EMTs who felt that merely by publishing the details of some of the disciplinary cases, we were denigrating the entire profession. But a lot of the complaints that they made about the difficulties they face as volunteers and the lack of public support that they face were actually a big part of the focus of the articles, too. So,
Let me just read one of the letters to the editor of the Des Moines Register in response to this series. It comes from Steve Spendler, director of the Johnson County Ambulance Service located in Iowa City. Here's the quote in that letter to the editor. It is true that the method of delivery and quality of service varies greatly across the state because there is no requirement in Iowa to provide for EMS unless a community is committed to supporting and funding an EMS system. It is possible the quality of care will the quality of care will suffer. Reporter Clark Kaufman did a thorough job pointing out what is wrong with EMS in Iowa, supplying examples of services and individuals who are an embarrassment to EMS. For every one of those examples, there are scores of examples across Iowa of people with high professional integrity who provide excellent service to their communities. React to that, Clark.
Well, everything he says is accurate, of course, and you know, I've been at the Register for 11 years, and during that 11 years, I've seen us routinely report on the kind of heroic dedication that many of these EMTs demonstrate just day in and day out. We've profiled some individuals. We've written about the fundraisers and that kind of thing. This was the first time the newspaper had ever, not just in a big collective sense, but even just on a piecemeal basis, this was the first time the Register had ever looked at any disciplinary cases involving any EMTs. And it was the first time we'd ever looked at these broader system issues as well. And we did, you know, we did package the articles very deliberately and presented them to readers as a look at the challenges and problems within the system, as opposed to being a broader story of the entire EMS system, good and bad.
You said the initial look into this area began years ago?
It would have been at least 3 years ago when I first began to get a sense that there were some real system-wide problems that we had never even touched on, as well as just the fact that although we routinely looked at all aspects of medical care in Iowa from sort of a critical standpoint, you know, where are the problems, where are the disciplinary cases, but we had never looked at that first sort of critical point in urgent care, which is the EMS system. And that was, I think, just because it's an entirely separate entity unto itself, the regulatory function is.
Any idea of the hours that you and the Register put into this?
You know, I don't.
A guesstimate.
I couldn't even guess, because as I say, it was spread out over at least a few years. And part of that was because I wanted to get a good sense of where some of the issues really were. But the other thing was, is the system standards that the Bureau was proposing 3 or 4 years ago, I fully anticipated, well, we're 2 years into the process now. I'll write about some of these things once we get these system standards in place and they're mandatory, because that would be a very positive thing. But it became clear to me, I think about last summer, that that simply wasn't going to happen. There was too much resistance within the EMS community, and as the letter writer pointed out, we don't even require EMS service in Iowa, and that was a big stumbling block toward making any improvements in the system.
So, Kaufman, sorry to cut you short. We have about 30 seconds left. What do you hope to be the outcome here?
I don't know that there will be any changes. I don't think there's any political will there. The governor has made it clear simply that he's supportive of the volunteers who prop up the system, but he's not willing to even address the issues of background checks or system standards or bureau funding.
Clark Kaufman, thank you for joining us. Des Moines Register reporter, investigative series that looked at the Iowa's emergency medical services. Clark, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up in just a moment, we'll talk about the spring rains. Nothing new for us Iowans, but the torrents of rain that some have visited some parts of Iowa have been incredible. Over 8 inches in the last 24 hours in North Liberty. If it's touched you in a significant way, we want to hear from you in this next half hour. 1-866-780-9100. We'll be talking with a number of people, doing some check-ins, also talking with two hydrologists about the flood threat. That's coming up in this next half hour. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Dry creek beds turning into raging streams, streams turning into raging rivers, ponds appearing out of nowhere, it seems, in some low-lying areas in southern and eastern Iowa. Well, we know spring storms, nothing new for us here in Iowa, but what a week it has been. What an April so far. What are we, the 18th of April? According to the Weather Service so far this month, 14 cloudy or partly cloudy days, just 3 clear days out of those 18. Yesterday, made its case for the worst day of the month weather-wise, downpours causing flash flooding in southern and eastern Iowa. And as we've been hearing in our forecasts, it ain't over yet. We want to check in with some areas in the state hit heavy by the rains this half hour. I want to talk in a moment also with two hydrologists about the flood threat. We want to have your picture of where you experience it. If you've been significantly impacted by the incessant rains, the deluge, the downpours, how has it complicated your life? For now, please tweet us on our Twitter page, give us a tweet, or post something on our Facebook page, or send us an email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. A little later, we'll invite you to call in. Let's check in with a few people. We heard in our news, Johnson County's emergency management officials declaring a local disaster, even as they continue to assess the damage caused by more than 8 inches. I thought it was a typo when I saw it. 8.28 inches of rain recorded in North Liberty, north of Iowa City, in little more than a day's time. And joining us to talk about the situation in North Liberty, Don Connolly, the street superintendent there, joining us by phone. Hi, Don. Let me click you into radio existence. Sorry about that, Don. Hi.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Wow. Give us the picture after eight inches of rain.
Well, we have a very high-tech weather station that we installed in a project on one of our traffic signals centralized in town here. And in a 28-hour period, we exceeded 8.28 inches of rain, which is a very large event that I've not seen in 28 years here with the city, and probably not in my lifetime. What I think happened was our ponds, our storm sewers were saturated. They were overwhelmed. People's sump pumps couldn't keep up because possibly, you know, we're going through a drought, and then the dirt shrank away from their homes. The water immediately ran down the side of their foundations. Sump pumps were overwhelmed. They weren't able to pump into our storm sewers because our storm sewers were overwhelmed. So we have several homes that flooded.
Mm-hmm. And I understand the sewer system for the city was overwhelmed.
Correct. And I do believe that is probably from the sump pump failure or the storm sewers being overwhelmed, and the sump pumps couldn't sump pump the lines or the water into the overwhelmed, overwhelmed storm sewers. Mm-hmm. So that automatically goes into the drains in their basement, which surcharged our sanitary mains.
Does that mean the sewer system, that we have sewage going into our rivers and streams there?
We have a small amount. We called the DNR yesterday. We had to have permission from our administrator to go ahead and do the bypass. And under state regulations, that has to be proved that we were going to save property and further undo property damage to homeowners. So we did a minor bypass on one part of our town last evening for approximately 4 to 5 hours. We kept track of that and approximately how many gallons. And all that did was just keep a small area from getting more.
How many gallons of sewage then didn't have to be dispersed this way?
We're right now on a guesstimate, we're guessing 70,000.
70,000 gallons?
Yes.
Okay, of sewage. That has ended, though, after these 5 hours or so.
Yeah, that was last night, and then we bypassed again this morning for about an hour and a half until we relieved the system. But, you know, you've got to remember that a lot of this is stormwater coming from basements, from their sump pumps. So
right, it's a mixture.
A lot of it's, it's diluted.
Okay. Don Connolly, the picture, a quick picture of what the neighborhoods look like in North Liberty?
It's something that I haven't seen probably since, you know, 93. We had some streets closures yesterday, I believe 7. Of course, we had them reopen as soon as the water receded. We do have some road damage out in the rural areas that we are fixing today, and we're continuing with all staff members, police, fire, parks, water, to ensure the intakes are cleaned and we get more rain that we can go back to normal operations.
Don Connolly, Street Superintendent in North Liberty, thank you for this chat, and we hope your cleanup goes well.
Thank you.
North Liberty experiencing more than 8 inches of rain over the last 28 hours, Wednesday and today into Thursday. Let's check in with a reporter you just heard in our news, Duri Buscaran. Hi, welcome to our Iowa City studio. You're usually out. Yesterday you were out in Solon, which is also north of Iowa City, one of the areas heavy hit by flooding. Give us the picture that you found in Solon.
Well, driving into Solon, I mean, the first thing you see on Highway 1 was that Randall Park was completely... It looked like soup. There was just so much water, you couldn't even see the ground, and all of the mulch apparently was washed away. So that'll probably be looked at later. They sent out a call for volunteers around 11:30 in the morning for sandbagging.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially people showed up within a half hour and were putting sand in bags, and then people were just taking them to their neighborhoods, to their homes. I visited a neighborhood that it seemed like a pond had just sprung up in the middle of a cul-de-sac because, I mean, after when you have so much rain so quickly, it just comes out of nowhere.
We have to remember Solon does not have a river there, does it?
Exactly. And that, I mean, they were really concerned about a wastewater treatment plant near a creek and had to put sandbags there and got a pump from the Department of Transportation, I was told, to kind of address that, and apparently did not have to bypass and put any untreated water into the river system, but it was a concern for a long time.
Do you know what the picture is, picture in Solon today?
The rain did taper off, I'm told, and I don't think that the wastewater treatment plant sustained any damage, and okay. I think it's getting better.
I understand a children's park washed away.
Yes.
Yeah?
Randall Park,
which you mentioned. Thank you very much for that update, Duri Buscaran, for telling us a little bit more about Solon. You've been reporting on it. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And let's go to the central part of the state, central and western part of the state, Pella and Knoxville area, where they have a local radio station. It's KNIA and KRLS. And the station director, Bob Leonard, joins us by phone. And Bob, are you there? Hi, Bob.
Hi, Ben. How are you?
I'm doing fine. What kind of rain totals do you have there in the Pella Knoxville area?
Well, it sounds like, I was a little depressed about it this morning, but it sounds like we're lucky. I think we're heading only to 5 inches. Our 5 inches has hit us pretty hard, though.
Mm-hmm. Give us a picture of what has been the outcome, the result of that 5 inches.
Well, it wasn't for us, it wasn't not only the rain, but it was the lightning yesterday. The lightning, one of the first things we did in the morning was went to there was a lightning strike at a home, and everybody made it out okay, but lightning was everywhere. It hit a mission tower near Pella. Lots of different places near Pella and Knoxville were hit by lightning. Perhaps even the Pella Library lost some servers that might have been hit by lightning. We are near there anyway, enough to do some damage to electronics inside. I woke up this morning at 4 o'clock. I knew it was going to be a long day when the county roads guys called me and said that we had some major flooding. We had roads closed, G71 near Bussey, and then interestingly enough, and a major, major disruption is Highway 5 running from Knoxville all the way to the county line, and there's a lot of trucks move up and down that road, and essentially we're at the point now where Bussey is almost an island, our little town of Bussey, and then, as you know, as the earth gets more and more water in it, the earth starts to move, and we had a big water main break in the rural part of the county, south and east of Knoxville. And so, those big rural water towers?
Sure.
That line broke and that tower drained.
And oh, so my
we've
goodness.
Got hundreds of people without water right now. There'll be a boil order. I believe they've located the problem and they're working hard to fix it.
Okay.
We have cable outages, phone outages. Once the water gets into the earth, it starts messing with our electronics, combined with the lightning, the flooding, the road closures. It's a busy day here in Marion County.
Bob Leonard, local radio station director of KNIA and KRLS. Bob, thank you for giving us the picture from that area, the Pella Knoxville area.
You bet. You're welcome.
And finishing up this hour, we want to get a big picture from a couple of our guests. Ray Wolf is joining us. He's a National Weather Service hydrologist based in the Quad Cities, joining us by phone. Hi, Ray.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you. Dry, I can safely say. Witold Krajewski is with us in our Iowa City studio, director of the Iowa Flood Center in Iowa City. Witold, welcome to you.
Glad to be here.
Ray Wolf, let me turn to you because people are looking to see if this is over. Current flood, give us the current flood status in parts of Iowa, how it's likely to evolve in the next couple days given the forecast we have.
Okay, well, right now we're kind of transitioning from that flash flood, sort of the reports that you've heard, into more of a river flood scenario. So our tributaries, Skunk, Des Moines, Iowa, Cedar, Wapsipinicka, and Maquoketa are all going to see pretty hefty rises, and those will translate downstream into the Mississippi River as well. In terms of precipitation, we have some light rain across parts of the state and even snow up in the northwest. That shouldn't add any further to the problem, and we see a few dry days coming up through the weekend until our next chance of precipitation on Sunday through early next week. But that appears to be, at least at this point, on the light side and nothing at all like what we experienced the last few days.
Mm-hmm. Do we know yet if that was, for instance, in North Liberty, over 8 inches in 30 hours, a record of some sort?
Well, we don't have specific records like that, but we can look at our data and see that an event like that probably in any given year in a community has a less than 1% chance of occurring. So it shows that from a meteorological and hydrologic point of view, it's a very unusual event, but not outside of the range of what can happen in our part of the world.
Mm-hmm. What has to happen, Ray Wolf, in the atmosphere for that amount of rain to fall from the skies?
Well, you know, these spring storms, when we have the cold air to the north and the warm, humid air to the southeast, we get those tremendous contrast, and that's kind of a proxy for the amount of energy that's in the atmosphere. And that energy translates to thunderstorms and rainfall and snowfall production. And that's just the ingredients came together in just the right way to really bring a deluge to basically about the southeast third to southeast half of the state.
Witold Krajewski, also with us, director of the Iowa Flood Center in Iowa City. Give us your reaction to what's happened here in the last 30, 48 hours in Iowa.
Yes, this was an incredible event. I can call it, you know, spectacular, only spectacular if you are watching it on the radar, you know, screen.
And if you have a dry basement.
And if you have that, that's right. I can say that ever since being established, the Iowa Flood Center, we have been preparing for something like this in the sense of putting together tools that will help monitor events like this and provide Iowans with better information. The fruits of this work, they are integrated in what we call Iowa Flood Information System, which is a web-based, you know, system available to everybody.
Tell us some details before we have to go. What specifically can people, where do they go? And iowafloodcenter.org is the website. What can be found there for everybody?
Yeah, so we show rainfall, you know, patterns. We show data that come in real time from some 150 what we call bridge sensors, so sensors that show the stage of streams and rivers. And we show all of this in a hydrologic, you know, context. So people can go there either looking at the entire, you know, state, or they can select their own community of interest. And that way they will get an outline of the upstream watershed. And that provides, of course, this hydrologic, you know, context, because the rainfall that is falling outside of the boundaries of the watershed is not something that they need to be concerned about. Well, the rainfall yesterday yesterday was widespread, and many communities are affected and will be affected for the next couple of days.
This tweet from Amy listening to our program: my basement was flooded this morning, and so was my route to work. I'm headed to buy a pump. I'm sure Amy's story is repeated many times across southern and eastern Iowa today. This also just from the DNR, quoting their release here: major flooding on the Mississippi and Iowa rivers caused by the recent heavy rains and snowmelts forecast to reach levels high enough to overtop the emergency spillway in the Odessa levee and flood the entire Lake Odessa complex in Louisa County. Also continuing with the quote, the current river forecast shows water levels reaching heights similar to the 2011 flood, which was the seventh highest flood on record in the area. End of that quote from the Iowa DNR. Ray Wolf, so hearing that and with the information that you have, how are we set if we look at the forecast for the potential for even worse flooding as the spring is just starting?
So we still have some snow up into the Minnesota area. So the character of that snow melt and additional rainfall in the coming weeks, of course, determine how long this flood event gets dragged out. But right now, from Dubuque down to Fulton, Illinois, in that area, we're looking at only minor flooding. And locally here in the Quad Cities, moderate flooding, and then from Rock Island downstream is where the worst of the flooding is on the Mississippi. And indeed, that looks to be kind of a top 10 event. Given that the soils are so moist, which is actually great news for agriculture coming out of the drought, we are very sensitive to additional rainfall, so that's what we'll be looking closely at in the coming weeks.
Vitold Krajewski, what can you tell us looking forward? Because I know you have all this incredible technology. You're collecting more and more data, which you described a little bit there. How does that help us make long-term predictions or help us when we're in the situation that we are right now?
Well, this type of information was not available in 2008, for example, let alone 1993. So now people of Iowa can monitor what is going on. They can monitor, rainfall, the status of the streams, and rivers, and make their own, decisions. Together with the National Weather Service, we provide, forecasts for many locations. So again, that should help, people with making, decisions. By collecting all this information, we are improving the ability of making, predictions in the future, both in short term as well as long term.
And once again, to find out, get a handle on all that data, which is accessible to the public. I think the best thing to do would probably just to send your search machine to Iowa Flood Center, and you'll find it, won't you, Vitold?
Very, very easily. Yeah, if you just Google Iowa Flood Center, it will come up, and then IFIS, Iowa Flood Information System, is very prominently featured. There you push the button and you will have access to all this information.
Tell us quickly, I know the Iowa Flood Center working with NASA. In what capacity, Vitold, working with NASA?
Yes, this is very interesting. So NASA is preparing a satellite mission. This is to be launched next year. And this mission is devoted to providing rainfall and snowfall observations worldwide. And NASA selected to work with us to conduct a field experiment here in Iowa to collect information mostly on rainfall to improve those algorithms that will convert the information that can be obtained from space, looking down into the quantities of rainfall that can help people worldwide in predicting, floods, landslides, and just to better manage water resources. So this is very exciting, for us. They selected us as their partner for several, reasons. One kind of unfortunate is because we do have floods here in Iowa.
Yeah. I'm wondering if it's particular in southeast Iowa, we have just a minute or so ago to left, but because of the layout of the watershed, is southeast Iowa particularly susceptible to floods?
Well, it all depends on the tracks of the storm. So, okay. You know, yes and no.
Okay. The geography figure into any of this for you, Ray Wolf, at the National Weather Service?
So not so much other than being kind of in the part of the country where during this spring season in April, storms of this nature tend to track.
Okay. So we are, Ray Wolf, Witold Krajewski, crossing our fingers for what? That we just get a little time to dry out, to let the soil absorb this, and to let our rivers tame down a bit, huh?
Exactly.
Okay. I want to thank you very much. Ray Wolf, hydrologist with the National Weather Service in the Quad Cities. Thank you, Ray.
Thank you.
And thank you for joining us, Witold Krajewski, director of the Iowa Flood Center in Iowa City. And once again, to find out all about the fascinating things the Iowa Flood Center is doing, just set your sites, your browser on Iowa Flood Center, Iowa Flood Center, those three words, and we'll put that up on our Facebook page. I think we can do that. Witold, thank you for joining us, coming into our studio.
Thank you, Ben.
Thank you for joining us with a look at what's been happening with the weather throughout the state. We're hoping everybody dries out, stays warm. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Technical support from Dennis Reese, the executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows, is Catherine Perkins. We always welcome your comments and questions. Post something to our Facebook page. Send us an email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Tomorrow on this program, we'll look at casinos, the expansion of casinos in the state, and ask the question, how many is too many? Tomorrow on our Friday edition of River to River, I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us. Thank you.